Welcome to the 10K Collective podcast. Ladies and gentlemen, this is your host, Michael Veazey. So today we have the concluding part of a mini two-part series about business model defensibility. A business model is a fundamental sort of structure that underlies your ability to make profit, or indeed things that get in the way of you making profit or will in fact destroy your entire business. So something quite big picture stuff from the business point of view, but really, really critical. Never been more important than under COVID and with strange great opportunities and great problems like we face in 2020. It's never been a better time to think about this. So you'll learn today how dominating a niche makes it really hard for competitors to attack you, the power of a particular kind of data, and the power of making your product sticky. I'm not talking about getting it covered in honey or something either. So if you want to hear what more those things are about, you better stay listening. As ever, if you like the TEL, the e-commerce leader episodes, then do consider subscribing to the e-commerce leader at any podcast app near you.
We are Michael Veazey in London, England.
And Jason Miles in Seattle, Washington.
More importantly, you are the owner of a thriving online business and you want to become the best e-commerce leader you can be. We're here to get you there.
For show notes with links and resources mentioned today, and for other juicy resources like downloads and free mini courses, just visit our blog, theecommerceleader.com.
Talking then of having lists of people in general, which I suppose includes followers on YouTube, what have you, how does that fit into your business and your clients' businesses?
Yeah, I mean, and it's a great question. A lot of people ask when I talk about this in the Seven Moats list, I talk about data being a method of defensibility. And, you know, when you think about what you're doing as a business owner, and you have, let's say, just an email list, you start with 100 people, let's say, and, you know, that seems like achievable goal for anyone, just to say, okay, I'm going to get to 100 people on a newsletter list. What you're doing is you're aggregating data that you then have the right to use legally. And when you get a customer's contact information, you have opportunity to do subsequent marketing. And that's obviously what many Amazon sellers get frustrated with over time is, I can't contact customers. I can't communicate. There's a firewall there. And so when you don't have that firewall there, when you add that level of defensibility into your own business system where you have the data, you have a really, really powerful, opportunity. And it's a sword and a shield. It's, when I talk a lot about the nine mountains of traffic, I talk about it being the proactive outreach step, the sword, but the shield concept is just as powerful. If, let's say you have a new upstart competitor who comes after you, if they've got a list of 100 people and you've got a list of 100,000 people, then you talk to a lot more people about whatever they're doing. And, you have a layer of defensibility because you've got more information. Obviously, in the last few years, collecting phone numbers has been all the rage so that you can do text-based marketing. And that's just another layer of data but in my mind, it all goes into this idea that data is it's a sword and a shield, but it gives you the opportunity for defensive, approaches to compete with people who are coming after your business and trying to win the day and convert all your customers into their own. And data can be really, really powerful tool in that regard.
And it sounds like what you're saying with data is data plus permission to use it. Is that right? That's the distinction.
Sure. Of course. Yeah. Legally, and so that means every time, just one little example, you have a Shopify site. If you have it set up improperly, you'll have people checking out anonymous and no methodology for them joining your newsletter list and opting into your marketing. Well, you've just missed the opportunity. So, literally yesterday I was helping a client set up his loyalty program. And so now people can accept that, can create an account and join his loyalty program. Well, he's just added another layer of data that he has the right to then do creative marketing with. Yeah, those are the examples. Yeah.
Excellent. So, well, that does make sense. And just one tiny point to that is that it is possible. You're quite like the Amazon sellers are frustrated with this all the time. And there is a kind of firewall and you just have to come up with imaginative ways to work around that. I mean, one thing, for example, is that you can drive Facebook traffic and then capture that and then send them on to Amazon. And then, of course, you have started data. To create your own, yes, exactly, data and community potentially as well if you go further with it. So it is starting to happen. Most people are a bit slow adopters with this, and I would really encourage people to do it, but can be done.
Yeah, let me ask you about this next one, and that's the culture of innovation. And the idea that, you know, there's a lot of famous quotes about this, the idea that, you know, Wayne Gretzky, I think, was famous for saying, you don't skate to where the puck is, you skate to where the puck is going to be. Yeah. And the idea that, you know, if you do have competitors who are coming after you by copying your existing product, in a lot of ways, the only way around that is innovate new products that they don't know you're doing. And then you've got this secret stealth lab of awesomeness that you reveal to the world, and your competition says, "Ah, crud. You know, now they've one-upped us again." And if you can do that over and over, I think there's power there. What are your thoughts on how that plays out in the Amazon space and in your 10K Collective group? Have you seen people who have done a good job at innovating constantly?
Constantly, maybe not. I mean, it's interesting. I mean, first of all, just to clarify for British listeners, Wayne Gretzky is presumably an ice hockey player, right?
Yes.
So that's where the puck, because we don't do a lot of skating in this country. When we do, pucks belong in a hockey field, which is a very British tradition. So, okay, yeah. So hockey metaphor, which makes a lot of sense. So Amazon sellers have a bad habit of innovating in the sense of hacking at the algorithm in a sort of very tactical way and thinking they're innovating, but that has a very short life expectancy. So I think that is now dying a death, and I'm glad of that, because it gets very exhausting to discuss it all and figure it all out. But one or two of the things I've mentioned already, I mean, I think licensing is relatively innovative for Amazon sellers, even though it's been around for a long time as a business model. As I say, one of the members is doing that and looking really set to be very good, because it's in a certain type of product category that's been hit by COVID. We'll have to see the proof down the line. I've mentioned the Facebook group, and somebody else is driving Facebook traffic, so advertising traffic, to sign up for ManyChat and then following up with them. And one of the innovative things he's doing is giving them a cheaper product in order to, you know, basically in recompense for a review. So it's against terms of service, but it's outside the Amazon ecosystem, so they can't see it. So those are a couple of examples that spring to mind. So people are doing it. It's not yet very widespread, but as you say, it's really important.
I like that. The innovation in the marketing techniques, of course, is something that we, I guess we all do that. Yeah, I hadn't thought of it that way. I was thinking more product innovation, but you're right in pointing out that many times if you don't innovate in product, or you have a commoditized product, then the culture of innovation applied to the marketing techniques is what makes the leader become the leader over time. I mean, the best marketer wins frequently. And that's interesting. Yeah,
you're right. But actually, you put your finger on a thing which I think generally I see less work going into, because it is a fantastic amount of work, I guess. At least that's my perception. I mean, let's see your thoughts on this. But my perception is that developing a product, even if you've got an existing product and you're developing from that, is a massive amount of money, time and effort. So tacking on a bit of Facebook marketing or something is relative to that a pretty small amount of effort. I mean, does that sound true to you?
Yeah, I think so. You know, the thing about it is there's a real dance that we all have to do, which is the investment of time and energy into a future project. And there are examples where a long process of innovation and work goes into a product, and it becomes the sensation, the biggest thing ever, the award-winning product that no one else can top. That's the best case outcome of the long, you know, the slow growth or slow methodical work on a product. The opposite obviously happens as well, where somebody's toiled away for 3, 4, 5 years on an idea and it never comes to fruition. There is no good outcome. And those are painful, you know, days. But that's the dance. How do we as entrepreneurs know how long and how hard to invest into a new innovative concept or idea before we test it? And, you know, there's been in the last 5 years, 10 years, this culture in internet world of go fast and break things. You know, Reid Hoffman's famous, and if you know who he is, he's a really genius guy, LinkedIn founder and co-founder of PayPal. His famous quote is, if your first version of your product isn't embarrassing, you've waited too long to launch it. Now, there's an artist would never believe that's true. An artist would argue the other side of the point. And so there's hard work to do there. And I'm not sure there's a short or easy answer either way.
No.
If the ultimate thing is, does your product hit the market and can you figure out a way to make it work at volume? And if that's true, if you can get velocity of sales, then you rewrite history. And whatever you did to get there was the right thing. You know, if you went fast, it was the right thing. Yes. If you went slow, it was the right thing. So.
Right. There is a survivorship bias in a lot of these tales, whether it be about some big famous corporate examples or even just the people that you know who've killed it on Amazon or Shopify. But I would just reference a couple of obvious reference points, which is, number one, The Lean Startup by Eric Ries, which I think you and I both read and found a bit hard work, but I think it's worth revisiting the concepts behind these things. Ash Moria's done a slightly more cut down version, I think, called Running Lean, which is by no means intellectually easy to read, but interesting. Yeah. And the other one is, of course, Jim Collins in there. I think it's Great by Choice, where he did massive studies of these huge corporate giants. And so therefore, they're not directly applicable to 6, 7, 8-figure sellers or businesses. But what he did pull out of that is that strategy of fire bullets, then fire cannonballs. Mm-hmm. So exactly that question of innovation, you know, not putting 5 years into something that turns out to fail, but not innovating at all being another issue. Yeah. So those, I think, are very worth reading for anyone who's read them or rereading.
Yeah.
That would be the main thing that strikes me.
I know in prior conversations, you've mentioned that there, you know, we've brainstormed this list a little bit and you've talked about other economic modes that can, you know, like economic, financial, pricing type ideas that immediately come to your mind in terms of other opportunities to be, you know, defensive with your work. What are your thoughts on that? Beyond the list of seven here, things that come to your mind?
Yeah, well, I mean, some obvious things are economic moats, like having more money, which is a sad thing to have to talk about, because obviously a lot of us don't have, you know, millions and millions to invest in things. Yeah. And some people do, not many, but I've stumbled across the odd person who has literally hundreds of thousands of pounds to invest and no expertise. But yeah, how do we deal with that? Mm-hmm. I mean, because obviously you're going up against a Walmart or a Tesco's in the UK, mm-hmm. and they're selling an item. They have so much money, we can't compete. So what's that all about, the economic moat there?
Well, I mean, I think the interesting piece there is, I think that's why probably the concept of guerrilla marketing was born. Who's the guy? Jay Levinson, for goodness sakes, guerrilla marketing. I can't remember the author's name, but it's a famous set of books. And I think that's the reason he invented the idea was, guerrilla marketing is what you do when you don't have any money, but you're competing against, a giant enemy. And there's strategies there that you can play out. One example that comes to my mind, because I'm locally here with Microsoft close by. I remember it years ago now, Microsoft launched its Encarta CD-ROM based encyclopedia. And this is an interesting little story. I heard the math on this, and I think it was in either the book by William Poundstone, Priceless, The Myth of Fair Value, or it was maybe in Free, The Future of a Radical Price by goodness gracious.
It's cool. We'll look it up. And
Chris Anderson.
Chris Anderson. Yeah. That's the one. Yeah.
So this example of namesake in England is Encyclopedia Britannica. Was the original, you know, item that was being sold, I believe, at $600 million a year, door-to-door sales in the United States, something like that. Back in the olden days, the door-to-door salesman would knock on your door and they'd have a suitcase full of Encyclopedia Britannica books and ask to come in, and it was very awkward. And they would basically sell you on the idea of having a set of encyclopedias in your house. And for middle-class and upper-class families, they all had Encyclopedia Britannica sets. $600 million a year business. And then Microsoft, when it launched Encarta, they vaporized that business, destroyed it, and they made it about $100 million a year line of business for Microsoft, a CD-ROM driven, you know, product. Now, $100 million a year, still interesting, but they had destroyed Encyclopedia Britannica door-to-door sales. And then we all know what happened next, we're familiar, Wikipedia came along, Jimmy Wales created Wikipedia. He vaporized it even more and made it basically a public good. He made Wikipedia sort of just out there, and it's now funded by donors, and he has good backers. And I think Jimmy Wales, I heard somewhere, is worth like $22 million. So he's not poor.
No.
You know, but he created this economic moat around the idea of encyclopedia content that's unbeatable. And, you know, nobody's going to top that because it's free, you know? And so I think there's a lot of interesting concept there in terms of what you can do with economics, price points, and that kind of thing of your business. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, in a way, we have to be scrappy and use that guerrilla marketing book. We'll look up folks, by the way, who wrote it, and we'll put it in the show notes, which are, as ever, at theecommerceleader.com. Do head down there, where we have various things, including books that Jason's just launched as well. So do check that out at the blog. So I've just realized, of course, we missed out on one of the final piece, which is the high switching costs, which is quite an interesting topic. I'm not sure that anyone really thinks about that at all. So can you give me an example of any of your clients or in your own businesses where you've managed to innovate sort of high switching costs? And can you just, you know, elaborate on what you mean by that as well?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think the interesting stories there are related to creating a product concept that's so holistic. I mean, Steve Jobs is famous for calling, you know, their idea a walled garden. It's so holistic that you get people into your way of working with your product or your system that it's not relatively easy for them to back out of the deal, and they don't want to. I mean, in the best case, they're happy inside your walled garden. You know, Keurig Coffee Company is a good example. Green Mountain Coffee, if you're familiar. I know, Michael, Green Mountain, a household brand in England at this point, and Keurig Coffee.
I don't think it is. I'm not very good at shopping because my wife is like the queen of shopping, so she buys all the household goods like that. So
do you have a traditional coffee pot, like 8 cups, or do you have like a K-cup system?
I don't even know what that is. I think that's more of an American thing. We have a cafetiere or a French press, as you would call it, or cafetiere, as I would call it.
Okay. So let me describe the story. Sorry, it's maybe American-centric story more. But there was a tiny little coffee company in Colorado, I believe, and it called Green Mountain Coffee. And, you know, coffee is a commoditized system. Absolutely brutal. I launched the Three Esters Farm coffee brand to help support my charity at one point and realized how hard it was to rank on Amazon with coffee. And it's brutal. So this little company is like, what do they do? Well, they had this technology that they had seen and kind of created, if I get the story right, at least, that was K-cups, which is little plastic cups, single serve cups that you insert into a machine. And the machine is sold to support the K-cups. Well, they licensed that and had, I believe, a 17-year patent on the deal. And it became so popular, they've literally become a massive, massive company. Now it's Dr. Pepper and Keurig that are together, the two brands. And they went from zero to just absolutely dominant position by having this, you know, high switching cost concept baked into their coffee delivery. And it's an interesting tale. I mean, you know, there's a lot to unpack there, I guess, is what I could say. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's very interesting. I mean, what's so interesting about that in a very, what's the word? It's in a brutal commoditized product like coffee, which is literally a commodity in the stock market. You can buy and sell it. So that's a sign that's really, truly a commodity, right? That you do not want to be in it. They basically innovated on the delivery system for it, if you like. And that's an extremely American thing that's driven by a sort of convenience. And that's been a trend in American consumer products for, well over 100 years, right? The creation of fridges and, you know, anything you like. It's an American invention. You guys are famous for that. So that's really interesting. And what's so interesting as well, we were talking earlier about the license, sort of bringing it back round almost to what we were talking about at the beginning, that licensing, we talked about licensing as a form of moat for people to have a quasi-monopoly if you are the licensee. But if you're a licensor, unlike these guys are, then you've not only have they created high switching costs, but they've created a sellable asset, which is in the intellectual property arena, which is just genius.
Yeah.
Because I guess these guys, they don't have to manufacture K-cups anymore to make money from it.
Yeah.
They just collect royalty checks, I'm guessing. So, genius example. I really like it. And And my home example, which I know a lot less about, is just simply Gillette, which I think Seth Godin mentioned in Akimbo. There's a really nice podcast, just fantastic. I really like Seth Godin, like everyone, but I think his podcast, by the way, is some of his best content. I love podcasts. That's why we're doing one, I guess. But he talked about Gillette, and Gillette's, you know, got these razors that they sell you at a certain price, but then you're stuck with the Gillette system. And I'm personally use them, and you know, we spend a fortune on those, but I like the feel, I like the system. I don't want to have to change over. So yep. That's another classic example, which if we can innovate to, in a way, be part of that, we've got it made, really. So I think we've covered all of those things in some detail. Would you mind just summarizing those seven moats again? Because we've gone over a lot of water has gone under the bridge since we started this conversation, I think.
Yeah, and let's bring it home here in terms of how to actionably, you know, kind of go forward. If you're listening to this, the question is, what do you do with this content? And here's some suggestions. So let me summarize the seven moats again and then give just a final kind of suggestion for how to use this content. The first one is a profitable in-demand product. Second, a high-functioning brand. The third is a tribe of true believers, loyal followers. The fourth is channel mastery or channel dominance. The fifth is data and customer information. The sixth is high switching costs or a sticky product concept. The seventh is an innovation of culture. A culture of innovation and, a system inside your business that makes products, and the idea that you're not just a one hit wonder, a one product company. You've got a culture of creating the next thing your customers are going to want. So those are the seven. Let me just suggest one simple idea, which is use this as a checklist. You ask yourself the question, do my business products or systems support any of these concepts, or can I apply any of these concepts to my existing business, or do I need to pivot and redefine how I'm working to create a more defensible long-term, business model idea that's safe, that protects me from competition and from becoming irrelevant to my ideal customers.
Yeah. Yeah, great idea. And I like the fact that although this is a strategy podcast, it's still actionable. You just need to, it might take you longer to action it, but I think having it as a checklist is an excellent idea. May I just add in another thought there, which is once you've gone through the checklist, I mean, I would just pick the lowest hanging fruit. I mean, if you realize that you actually got something of a tribe built, but you've been a bit slapdash about how you built it, and you've got maybe a lot of people have an email list of several thousand people of even if they're on Amazon, you can do email append services pretty cheaply, about 9-10 cents per email address. Quite a lot of us have got quite big email lists that we've neglected and not really nurtured. So that could be, for example, low hanging fruit. So I would suggest once you've done your audit, go take action on it as well. And then you'll really be getting value.
Absolutely. And of course, you're listening to this podcast, and we would love for you to help us create a defensible system here, which means we need subscribers, man. We need subscribers and we need reviews. And we'd love to have you download a few more episodes for your next drive to work or drive home or trip or whatever. We're really, really excited about the opportunity to serve our little but growing community through the e-commerce leader. And so that would be my call to action as well, is do us a favor, subscribe to the show, and leave us a review.
Absolutely. Amen to that. And listen, great, great topic. We've got some other things to deep dive into, but for the moment, I think we got plenty for people to chew on. So thanks very much for your seven moats.
Absolutely. Thanks, man.
That was the E-commerce Leader podcast with Michael Veazey in London, England.
Jason Miles in Seattle, Washington.
We offer you free help on our website, including PDFs, videos, and mini courses on topics like traffic, product, and sales channels. Some are for Amazon, most are for any sales channel. To get those and to stay up to date with our podcasts, go to www.theecommerceleader.com. Thanks for listening.